Hi, I'm Mark Rosenberg. I work with Ineta, and I'm here interviewing Matthew Roche, who is an MVP in SQL Server. He's also an MCT, Microsoft Certified Trainer, and you're here on Developer Week.
I am here for Developer Week. I'm actually working both weeks of the show here at TechEd 2008, but at Developer Week, I actually want to talk about integration services deployment.
And why do you want to do that during Developer Week?
Well, a lot of developers, when you think about deployment, it's about the least sexy thing that you can think of. So when you're a developer, you want to write code, you want to be working with the new technologies, you want to be building something new and exciting. That's what drives developers. It's what drives me. But for the last 2 years or so, I've been very in-depth into SQL Server business intelligence, especially SQL Server integration services. And what I've found is that the deployment story for integration services, even though there is a large set of tools and capabilities, everything that you need is there, it's really not obvious how to choose what tools you need, how to use them in a given scenario. And I do a lot of training, a lot of speaking engagements. And if I'm speaking at a code camp or a users group, I'll usually talk with the organizers to see, you know, what topics would you like me to speak on. And usually I will narrow it down to integration services because that's what I love the most.
Right.
And invariably they say, we want you to talk about deployment. And the first two or three times I saw this, like, deployment, boy, that's boring. How are we going to get 75 minutes out of deployment? But when I stepped back and looked at it, it makes for an excellent presentation. It's actually one of the breakout sessions that I'm doing next week for the IT Pro Conference. But it's something that I think any developer who is working with the Microsoft BI stack, the SQL Server BI stack, really needs to understand.
So deployment is a difficult thing to learn? Or?
Well, it's not necessarily difficult, but it's anti-intuitive. And I would say that there are three, and I'm going to make these bullet points up as I go, so there may or may not be three. but there are three main things that an integration services developer needs to do in order to have a successful deployment. So the first one, which kind of goes without saying, is to understand your tools, understand the capabilities of the platform. So the core tools that you need inside your packages are expressions and package configurations. So if you're a .NET developer building an ASP.NET application, it is a no-brainer that you have a web.config file.
Right.
You put all of the things that are deployment-specific that would break the location independence of your ASPX pages, you put them in your web.config file,
right.
And then if you're deploying from dev to test to prod, whatever, you update this one file, everything else is the same, it makes sense.
Right.
Now with integration services, there isn't a SSIS.config file per se, but there are things called package configurations.
And that's where you would put that kind of information?
Yep, absolutely. Anything that would break the location independence of your package, anything that is used to take the internals of the package and allow them to communicate with the outside world, that needs to go into a package configuration. And for the most part, that boils down to database connection strings, URLs, if you're connecting to a web service or an FTP server, the URL for the server, file system paths, things along those lines. And the mechanism is sort of what trips people up. So with ASP.NET, you have this file, but in your code, you will explicitly say, you know,
get this data out of the file.
Exactly.
That's how you would do it in ASP.NET. Well, how do you do it in SSIS?
Well, with SSIS, there's a bewildering array of options. So basically, you have different locations where you can store the data. You can store them in XML configuration files, which is DTS config is the default file extension. You can store them in a SQL Server database. You can store them in the registry. You can store them in environment variables. Or, to make things more complex, you can store the path to the XML file, the connection information for the database, or the registry key path in an environment variable to have an indirect configuration.
Is there some model? How do you make the decision of which of all of these choices to use?
Well, a lot of it comes down to the environment into which you're going to be deploying and who's going to be responsible for maintaining it once it's deployed.
Right.
I'm a developer. When I'm building things, I work on the file system.
Right.
So, the development environment is always on the file system when you're working with integration services. So you can't build a package in the database.
Okay.
So my personal preference is to have a file system-based deployment because you can deploy your packages to the file system or to the database as well. So I want a file system deployment where all of my package files are on the file system, all of my configurations are stored in XML files, but if it, if it is the DBA and not the developer or product team that is going to be maintaining these things, a lot of times, just because of the politics and strengths and weaknesses of the people on the team, it may make more sense to put the packages and the configurations in the database. So there's not really any one right answer. It really depends on who's doing what your goals are there.
I understand.
And the thing that trips a lot of people up is actually that environment variable aspect of things, because with integration services, a package may live on the file system, may live in the database, or it could be never persisted. You can actually create a package programmatically through code and execute it. And in that situation, there's no such thing as a current directory. So because of that, integration services doesn't have any real support for relative paths. So in order for you to say, go get this configuration file, it has to be C:// yada, 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 you know,
right.
whatever drive, but it must be a fully qualified absolute path. And this is very ironic, because the reason that you have these configurations
is to get away from that.
Is to have location independence.
Right.
You don't want to have any dependencies on your deployment environment. So in order to use them, you have to have this hard dependency, which is where the environment variables come in. So an environment variable is a flat namespace.
Okay.
It's the same on every machine. So if you, as part of your deployment script, you can create a batch file using the setx command utility. So setx will create the environment variables. Either copy or dtutil, which is an integration services utility, can get the packages into their final deployment location. So with that done, you can have the same environment variable on any given machine. Just on your dev server, it will have one value. On your test server, it may have another. On your prod server, it may have another. But it's something that can be repeatable and very easy to set up.
And all that can be done programmatically.
All of it can be done programmatically. Personally, I don't like to write code to do this. You know, I'm a developer, but
right.
I'd rather do it in a batch file. So very simple, easy to understand. It's not compiled, so you don't have to worry about maintaining it or things like that.
Right.
But if you have a batch file that creates your environment variables,
uh-huh.
a batch file that will deploy the packages themselves, and probably a batch file to test it once it's done. So the dtexec utility, which is the same command line utility you'd use to run your packages, as a /validate switch,
okay.
which is something that you can basically say, don't run it, just let me know that things work. So this way, it's a validation, or it can be a validation, to say, does the environment variable exist? Because you'll get errors or warnings if it doesn't.
Right.
Does the connection string that it contains point to a valid location? Just does a quick
so
smoke test.
It checks it to make sure everything will work once you actually try and run it.
Correct. And I would hesitate to say everything.
I was going to say, or at least as much as we can figure. You
yeah.
know,
that well, there are settings that you can... that you can define inside the package. The data flow, which is really where you're going to get bitten if something is wrong, the data flow has a delay validation property.
Uh-huh.
So there are lots of situations where it's valid to use this, but if delay validation is set to true, then saying validate doesn't do anything. It's because it's not going to get validated until you actually run it. In a situation like that, it's relatively straightforward to build a .NET utility that will essentially load the package into memory, turn
uh-huh.
that flag off, validate it,
okay.
dump the output, and discard the changes. But for the most part, that's kind of overkill. It would be nice to have,
uh-huh.
but it's something that you don't necessarily need to do. But the one biggest gotcha for environment variables comes down to how they work. So you're a developer, you're very experienced. when are environment variables read? You didn't know there would be a quiz. I realize that.
Yes, I didn't know there would be a quiz. Environmental variables are generally read early in the program, right before it starts. So
this is one of the questions I asked during my session. Very uh-huh. few people get this. Even people who have been doing development for a long time, environment variables are read at process startup.
Right.
And during not so much during deployment, but during package development, what's the process that you need to read these in? Visual Studio. So I have had so many times when it's me, I make the same mistakes
yeah.
over and over again. So I learned those lessons really well. But I will have situations where I need to create a new environment variable for a configuration. I'll create it, and I will shut down and restart the wrong instance of Visual Studio. Because I usually have four or five different instances
right.
running for the different things that I'm doing. And in that situation, it's cost me more hours than I care to admit. So
redo all this stuff because you've shut down the wrong instance.
Yep, or debugging, diagnosing. I know that this should work because I ran it. Look, I can see the environment variable from here. Why can't I see it from here? So, and it's very obvious in retrospect, but it's bitten me a couple times. But The key thing to keep in mind there is at deployment time, what is the process that you need to worry about?
Right.
So the environment variables themselves are run from DTEX, or sorry, the packages themselves are run from DTExec, but DTExec needs to be launched by some process. Most of the time you're going to set up a scheduled SQL Server agent job, so you actually need to restart the SQL Server agent service so that it can see the environment variables that you've
created.
Can
that be run as a Windows service as well? Would you be able to run it from just have Windows started, or do you need to have SQL Server to make it all work?
You do not need SQL Server to make it work. We're getting into a licensing area where I'm not going to go there, but
Okay. Basically
in order to use any of the SSIS stuff, you need a server license to run it on.
Right.
You don't need the relational database, you don't need SQL Agent, but you need something to trigger it. You could double-click on it, you could do any number of things, but most of the time it is a SQL box, and SQL Server Agent has robust scheduling and management capabilities.
True.
So 9 times out of 10, you've got your SQL Agent and not a Windows service. You'd have to build that service yourself.
Yeah, that's fine. I just was just curious if you could... if there were other options than just using SQL Server.
And therein lies the gotcha. There's so many options it's not that the tools aren't there, it's that there's so many tools. So the first thing, you need to know what's there. So we talked about configurations.
Right.
Expressions are basically a way to add additional conditional logic or dynamic logic to your packages. So think about in the .NET world, having the ability to add your own implementation for the property on a third-party class. So that'd be pretty cool,
right? That would be very cool.
So with SSIS, each component or most components will have an expressions collection where you basically say, take this property and override its value with this expression. Whenever the property is accessed, the expression, which is a custom syntax, it evaluates out to a scalar value, that expression will be evaluated, and instead of having a static value for the property, whatever you have in there, it just works. Your code runs, so you have the ability to hook up your logic to another component's properties, which is very cool.
Yes.
And the two of them together, generally what you'll do is you will set the value of a variable or something else inside the package via the configuration, and then have expressions that will use that variable as one of their inputs, reuse them in multiple places. So in my situation, I like to deploy to the file system, so I will have a single configuration that sets the root path. So this is where the stuff is deployed to. There's usually a group of projects with different packages in them. And then I will have other values that for any of the folders that need to be offset. So I've set my working directory, my current directory, manually.
Right.
And then I'll have other variables based on expressions that I can look at to see, here's the root folder, here's my project folder, here's my log file folder. But because I have the expressions, I can define it in one place and everything flows from it.
Very handy, very nice.
So the second thing that you need to do, so first of all, you understand the tools.
Right.
Second thing, understand your needs. So what do your packages need to do? And this is a very vague question, but it's
a very important question. It's also sometimes very hard to answer.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I like to do is to have a document that I'll build up that just has very, very brief, maybe one page per set of packages. For every package, what databases does it access? What file system resources, anything that is external to the package, make sure that it's documented in advance. You have that as a checklist, and then as you're moving from environment to environment to environment,
you can check your dependencies to make sure they're all set up properly.
Exactly. And inside the package, there's an object known as a connection manager. So a connection manager is essentially a gateway between your internal components and outside resources.
Okay.
Every connection manager has a connection string property, might point to a file, might point to a web server. So some people would say, well, what you need to do is you need to document your connection managers, but it's not that simple. So there are a few components, such as the XML source inside the data flow. There's a raw file, which is like a very high-speed binary file that integration services uses primarily for staging. So the raw file source and destination, they don't use connection managers. They have properties that you can set, but they don't use connection managers. In addition to that, integration services gives you the ability to add your own .NET code into the packages, so you can write this script task or script component, and it's up to you as a developer to use connection managers appropriately. There's nothing to enforce it.
Right.
So you might have code that you wrote that doesn't use a connection manager. You need to document that dependency as well.
Right, but that that gives you an incredible flexibility because you can write .NET code that will do almost anything.
So you're falling into the dev trap, just so you know.
Okay.
So that was my first impression when I started looking at integration services a few years ago. I can write my .NET code because DTS,
right,
the predecessor, the evil predecessor,
yes,
to SSIS, it allowed you to do ActiveX scripting, which was horrible. So
you're
no
creating
typing.
Those COM objects and,
right,
and trying to bring them into DTS and into SQL was very hard.
Yes, and it was poor performing, no developer experience. I was so excited about having real .NET code,
right,
but if you understand the tools, the tasks, and transformations that are in there, 9 times out of 10, you do not need to use the .NET code. So what I see if I'm doing a code review or as part of a consulting engagement going in and working with a group of integration services developers, if I see them with a lot of custom code, that's actually a danger sign. So it shows
they don't understand completely what they're doing, you think? Or?
Well, I think it shows that they don't understand the capabilities of the other tools that integration services provides out of the box. The tasks and transformations that integration services provides can be used in various combinations. There's lots of ways to put them together to solve very difficult problems in a simple declarative manner.
Okay.
Without any having the code to maintain. And you know, it works great. There's nothing wrong with doing it.
Uh-huh.
But once you have that code, you have actual procedural code that needs to be maintained. It's different from the nice graphical layout that integration services provide. So it's just something that when you start writing that code or start thinking about writing, stop, step back, talk to someone, make sure that it's something that you need to do.
Something that isn't provided by one of the other tools.
Absolutely. So you don't want to reinvent too many wheels. And as developers, you know, I want to make it round and it will roll.
Yeah, I know some developers that would rewrite the tools anyways.
Yes. So we talked about connection managers. We talked about documenting the external resources. But one of the other things that is not always obvious is the platform that you're deploying to can be very significant as well, such as a 32 or 64-bit platform. So integration services, even though it is a connectivity tool and connectivity platform, it doesn't do a lot of the true connectivity on its own. Integration Services 2005 was very OLEDB heavy, so they focused their development efforts on making the OLEDB experience very high performance, lots of capabilities.
Right.
So when you're connecting to SQL Server or Oracle or whatever database you're connecting to, you would generally do it through an OLEDB provider, and Integration Services is essentially just the client to that OLEDB provider that is going out and doing the true connectivity. With 2008, they've made a great investment in getting the ADO.NET, so the managed connectivity stack, up to the same standards as OLEDB. But for lots of different scenarios, the 64-bit and 32-bit drivers behave differently. Sometimes they don't exist. And sometimes there are just weird gotchas that until you see it, you would never believe that it's that Byzantine to do.
Okay.
So we mentioned the DTExec utility early on. So DTExec has two different versions. So if you have deployed, if you have a SQL Server deployed on a 64-bit Windows platform, you're going to have the C program files, yada, 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 SQL Server, DTS, and there's DTExec in there.
Right.
If you, and for the 32-bit, that's C program files, x86 in parentheses, yada, 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 SQL Server, down to the XE. If you run the one that's in the regular program files, that's the 64-bit version. If you run the one that's in program files x86, that is the 32-bit version. And the key thing is that when you're developing your packages, you're always developing on a 32-bit platform. Visual Studio is a 32-bit platform.
Right.
That means it's always using the 32-bit drivers.
And that could be a problem if you're going to deploy it on a 64-bit system.
Exactly. So what you need to do is, as part of your testing, you need to ensure that if you're deploying to a 64-bit server or if you have 64-bit as a supported deployment scenario, you must have a 64-bit server in your test environment. There's no way to get around that. It's going to bite you sooner rather than later. For example, Excel. So Excel is the world's most popular database. And I can't give you references, but I've heard this from enough people.
No, I was going to say Excel, everybody's favorite database.
Yeah, but apparently there is more data stored in Excel in the world than there is in any other database. You know, Teradata, SQL Server, Oracle, whatever. Excel has them beat. Just it scales out, not up.
Right.
So when you connect to Excel, you do it through the Jet OLEDB driver.
Okay.
There is no 64-bit Jet OLED-B driver.
No, Jet's old technology.
Yeah, Jet's
been around for a long time.
Right, absolutely. So if you're doing that, you must use the 32-bit version. Oracle. So if you are connecting to Oracle, obviously there are 64-bit Oracle drivers.
Right.
But this information, this is something I ran into maybe 9 months or a year ago, so things may have changed. But the 64-bit driver for Oracle was something that didn't work particularly well with integration services, and the 32-bit driver for Oracle wouldn't work because of the parentheses in the path.
Wow.
So it was a known error. They had patches that you could download, but it was one of those things where I learned this lesson the hard way. It's the way that I learned the best.
Right.
I was actually at a customer environment and was testing the 32-bit Oracle stack for the first time on a 64-bit server. I said, we're going to use the 32-bit stack,
right,
so we don't need to worry about the 64-bit driver because we had other 32-bit dependencies that we needed to use. So I figured it will just work.
And it didn't.
And I got to stay in Oklahoma for a few more days, longer than I had planned. So you need to understand your platform. You need to understand your deployment goals. So what servers, what platforms, what are you going to do? And I said that there were going to be three bullets, didn't I?
Yes, we're waiting for the last one.
So the third one is you need to have something that's repeatable, testable, and automatable. And I sort of foreshadowed this early on, and talking about the batch files that I like to use, or having a custom deployment utility to do all of the work for you. So there's something that I like to refer to as the poison candy. So picture the bowl in front of you.
Uh-huh.
It's sweet. It's delicious. It looks so good.
And it's going to kill you.
And it's going to kill you, or at least cause you a lot of gastrointestinal pain. So in integration services, there are some tools that are very attractive. They're very easy to use, and they're right there just dangling in front of you.
And you need to resist.
And
resist the temptation.
You need to resist.
Don't go there.
So one of them is something called a data source. And this is an overloaded term, but basically inside the integration services project in Visual Studio, there's a data sources folder, and you can add .ds files. And basically what they are is a connection string stored in a file, and then through the designers in Visual Studio, you can right-click and say new connection manager from data source.
Okay.
And because connection managers are they are a package object.
Uh-huh.
You can't actually have a connection manager that's shared by multiple packages. But a standard deployment, you're going to have 10 or 15 or however many packages,
right,
that all connect to the same source system. And,
duplicating things. Right. It just doesn't seem to make sense.
So the data source appears to be the perfect solution to this. It's it's defined at the project level.
Uh-huh.
It's built into the tools. It just works.
Right.
As long as you're in Visual Studio. Because what a lot of people don't realize is that the data source itself has nothing to do with integration services. It is a service and capability that's provided by Visual Studio. So when you deploy, unless you're deploying
it with Visual Studio, it stops working.
And unless you're going to run it in production by using Visual Studio,
right,
it doesn't work. So you need to understand data sources are a dead end. They're great for learning.
Uh-huh.
They're great for demos. They're great for a classroom environment. If you're doing a quick and dirty mock-up, great. If it's something that is going to be used anywhere outside of Visual Studio, don't use it at all. Start off with those package configurations we talked about early on. Configurations are more work to set up, but once they're set up, they work in dev, they work in test, they work in prod, they work in Visual Studio, they work in any environment because they're actually part of integration services.
And they're more flexible.
And they're much more flexible. The other poison candy is something called the deployment utility. So we wanted to.
We want to deploy it. I want to use the deployment utility, right?
It's a utility for deployment. This is what this is all about.
And I take it I don't really want to do that.
You really don't. So the way that you would set this up is you go into Visual Studio project properties, and there's a Boolean property. Do you want to create a deployment utility?
Right.
If you choose yes, it's going to copy your packages and give you a manifest file that when you double-click on the manifest, it'll give you a nice, pretty GUI.
Uh-huh.
What packages do you want? Where are you going to put it? How do you want to deploy them? It just works, right? But in that scenario, in order for it to work, you actually have to have somebody clicking on it every single time. There's no way to script it. There's no way to automate it.
Unless you're going to manually do it, it's not a really good option.
Right. And when you're deploying something, how many times do you want to click? Once. You want to click on the file and have it run with input coming in from something that you've tested and can reproduce.
Right.
Anytime that you have somebody choosing things from a list, anything along those lines.
There's always room for error.
There's room for error. And I like to think that I'm not horribly dumb, but I'm the guy that makes those errors if the errors are there to be made. So I try to plan around my own limitations.
Plan around yourself.
Exactly. So what I believe you need to do is to have a utility, sadly, that you've purchased, or sorry, not purchased, that you've built yourself. You know, batch files are dirt simple. They work great.
Uh-huh.
But have something that is hands-free, scriptable, automated. Run this. It's done.
So that I don't have to do anything.
Absolutely. Because the last time you want to be making choices about deployment is at deployment time. You make all those choices up front, and then when you go to deploy,
you push the button, here it is.
You push the button, or better yet, you're a developer. You don't want to push the button. You hand it off to your DBA or to your server administrator.
I give it to the IT staff and say, here, push the button.
Click on this.
Because they won't let me push the button on any of our real servers.
Absolutely. And because deployment is such, it's not really complicated, but it's an involved and non-intuitive process. It's one of those things that you need to start thinking about early on. And
most people don't until they get done with it, and then they say, oh, I got to deploy this. Now what do I have to do?
Absolutely. And if you've got 100 packages with no configurations, you have a job ahead of you. So that's basically what we've got. I think that we're running out of time. I see the next folks lined up. So thank you very much for having me here today.
Thank you, Matthew. We've been talking to Matthew Roche. He's a big fan of SSIS deployment.
Well, a big fan of SSIS, and the deployment is where I spend my time. So it keeps me busy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.